Morning. For the past 400 years or so, this has been one of the best known, most often cited, and most viciously argued over passages in all of the New Testament, as Protestants and Catholics have exegeted it to their own ends. You read some of the Catholic history of Catholic exegesis on this: "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." Jesus intended to found a church, in the sense in which we understand it today, created a papacy, appointed Peter to the head of it, gave him infallible authority, and promised him an infinite line of successors, and caused everybody else to know that they best listen up, or they'll be in trouble. All of which, of course, goes way beyond anything this passage would legitimately support. Protestant exegesis is no less tendentious, just in the opposite direction. Some people actually excise the passage. "Well, that couldn't have been in Matthew. It must have been a later edition." There is zero textual support for that hypothesis. And various other exegetical gimmicks and stretchings to try to minimize it, take it away, pretend it never happened. All of which can be fascinating reading and gives you a good idea of the history of exegesis and a real insight into the working of human nature, so that what it is that you're trying to prove can impact your judgment, your procedures, your results, even in sacred sciences like exegesis. But unfortunately, as all that's gone on for 400 years, it's tended to obscure the earlier part of the passage, which I think is the more important, and certainly the more important for us. Jesus' question: "And you, who do you say that I am?" And Peter's answer: "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." That's a pretty full proclamation of faith for this early in the gospel, and may actually not be historical. As Mark reports it, Peter's confession at this point is only, "You are the Messiah." In Mark, no one recognizes Jesus as Son of God until after the crucifixion, standing in the shadow of the cross. But Matthew brings that forward and adds it here because he wants a full proclamation of faith. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." But what does that mean? Certainly seems to please Jesus. Peter gets a major promotion out of it. But do we just repeat that? How do we answer the question? The question goes on through the ages. "Who do you say that I am?" Each of us has our own ideas about that, our own idea of who Jesus is, our own mental picture of Jesus. And they vary pretty widely. And all of them have a small element of truth somewhere, but none of them capture the fullness of the truth. You ask some people, "Who is Jesus?" And their immediate image is the infant lying in the crib on Christmas morning, or lying in the creche in the standard manger scene. Or, to carry it a little bit further, how many of you are familiar with the Infant of Prague, a baby Jesus dress-up doll? There are some people for whom the baby Jesus dress-up doll is their image of Christ. Probably a larger number, Christ is the sort of standard Victorian portrait that you see all in all the books. Tall, broad-shouldered, good-looking, fair-skinned, white guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, unwrinkled face, unwrinkled hands, surrounded by the cutest kids you've ever seen in all your life. Probably not terribly realistic portrait for a guy who was a Palestinian Jew, who was probably a lot shorter, whose skin was a lot darker, whose hair was black, who worked as a carpenter, and therefore had some scars on his hands and probably on his face. Carpentry, especially with hand tools, is not without incident when you do it for a living over decades. But still, it does capture some truth. And we'll come back to it. For other people, the image of Christ is the crucifix. They prayed over it for so many years. You say to them, Jesus Christ, and that's the image that pops into their mind. Jesus hanging on the cross. And not one of these sort of simple liturgical crucifixes, but the gory kind, with the blood running down into his eyes from the crown of thorns, streaming down his arms from the wounds in the wrists, or the hands, as they generally put it there. There's truth there, too. But it doesn't capture it. For some people, the image of Christ in their mind is Christ coming in glory. Have you ever been to the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington? They have this big dome in the center and a mural of Christ coming in glory. Except, instead of looking full of awe, he looks awful. The image I get from it is Jesus is coming and boy is he pissed. But if better done, it can inspire awe. And there's some truth in that too. But none of those images capture it. And none ever will. Our Holy Father, Pope Benedict, just this week, in an address to university professors in Spain, said, the human mind is incapable of knowing the truth. And everybody went, what'd he say? I mean, this is the guy who has denounced relativism, who has insisted that there is objective truth out there and that it can be known by the human mind and that we have an obligation to seek it. And actually, he didn't deny any of that. But what he was insisting on is the other side of that. The truth is larger than we are, and therefore we can never know the truth. We can know truth. We can know truths, but we can't know the truth. We know towards the truth. We know into the truth. But if the truth includes God, and God is infinite, as Paul was saying in that second reading, who knows the breadth and the depth and the glory, the wisdom and the judgment of God? It's literally incomprehensible. You can't get your arms all the way around it. So it doesn't work, or at least it has limitations. We don't know the truth. But we have to have some idea of who Christ is. We have to have some image in our minds when we pray. So we construct one, each of us, a different one. And that's okay, that's good, that's healthy, that's natural. Provided we realize that that's an idol. And as an old mentor and teacher of mine, Gene Walsh, used to say, every once in a while, you need to take your big hammer and go into your own little private shrine and smash all the idols. Grind them down, make powder, start over. Because as soon as we begin to fix an idea, think that's it, we're missing it. The baby lying in the manger, the baby Jesus dress-up doll, there's truth in that, real truth in that. It points to the fact that the incarnation is a fact, that Jesus became one of us, had to start out the way that we start out, and yet just as much to learn as we do. If you don't take adequate account of that, Gospels like last week, where Jesus is challenged to overcome his own ethnic preconceptions, become a question you can't deal with. But if you start off with a helpless infant in a manger, maybe you can. Of course, you don't want to stop there. There is no baby Jesus, any more than there's a baby you. You may still have baby pictures passed down from when you were an infant. And that's who you were, but that's not who you are. Jesus is not a baby anymore. And we limit ourselves to that. We miss the boat. Jesus was not historically 6 foot tall, fair-skinned, and blue-eyed. But there's truth in that. What they wanted to do when they painted that was to paint a Jesus who looked like them. Jesus is one of us. And that's true. And that's an important truth for us to know. Jesus is really one of us. There's no good reason in the world, therefore, why Europeans shouldn't paint a Jesus who looks European. An African shouldn't paint a picture of Jesus that looks African. An Asian artist produce a picture of Jesus that looks Asian. That's the truth. Provided, of course, that we realize that all those other portraits are just as valid as ours. That Jesus is not like us in our Europeanness or our Africanness or our Asianness, but Jesus is like us in our humanness. So while it's valid, it doesn't capture the whole thing. Jesus on the cross. This is an important historical reality and an important theological reality. Jesus really did undergo crucifixion for us. And crucifixion was a particularly ghastly, brutal form of execution. It's true. It happened. And it's just as important theologically as God poured God's self out fully into the world in Jesus. Jesus poured himself out fully, even unto death on a cross. But if we concentrate too much on that and think that is the truth, we're left with a dead Jesus. The cross makes sense only in the light of the resurrection. Just as the resurrection is made possible only by the cross. The Jesus coming in glory is a legitimate hope and aspiration and helps us nail down the reason why we keep moving. This is the prize that we keep our eyes on. But if you emphasize that and think of that as the truth, you can get too limited to the ethereal, the abstract, the long range, the theoretical, the intellectual, and fail to see Jesus in the everyday of your brother and your sister and their needs. So all those images are true, but none of them are the truth. The question continues to ring out. And you, who do you say that I am? Figure it out. Who do you say that Jesus is? And then figure out what's wrong with it. What's right with it first, but then what's wrong with it? And go in and knock the idol down and start over and build another one. What do you look for when building an image? Well, the gospel and the tradition of the church, I think, gives us three things to look for as we learn into the truth. First of all, Jesus must be fully one with us in our humanity. If you take John, who emphasizes Jesus' divinity, a little bit too far, you begin to lose track of Jesus' real humanity. And a lot of Christianity has done that. We get the divine mind walking around in a human body. That's not what Chalcedon said. Chalcedon said the fullness of the divinity, the fullness of the humanity, joined together in one person. Jesus' mind, human mind, was just as limited as ours. He was, as we heard last week, just as open to all the errors of his age as we are. Really one of us in all things but sin. When you have a hard time believing that, but it's important. On the other side, one with God in the fullness of God's divinity. That may be harder for us these days. In the old days, too. The early days of the church, there were all kinds of theologies that made Jesus some sort of intermediate being, higher than humans but lower than God. The church rejected all that. That Jesus needs to be fully one with us in our humanity, fully one with God and God's divinity. Otherwise, there's no bridge. If you want to build a bridge from here to here, it needs to have a firm anchor on each bank, or it's not going to carry any weight on the way over. We need to see the fullness of Jesus' divinity, God's knowledge, God's power, God's love dwelling in him. This experience that a great theologian of the last century called his Abba experience as the core of his being. We need to preserve that. And thirdly, the unity. United in one person. Not joined, not mixed. The humanity remains full and entire. The divinity remains full and entire, and yet joined in one person. How do you do that? How do you construct a mental model, much less an image, that does that? I think the answer is inadequately. But that's okay, because that's what we're capable of. We are not capable of knowing the truth, but we are capable of knowing truth, knowing into the truth, knowing toward the truth. And this is the truth, because who Jesus is for us will help determine who God is for us and who we are for ourselves. If we understand Jesus' humanity and Jesus' divinity, we know who God is and we know who we can become. And any shortchanging on either end of that shortchanges us. So it's a lifelong project. It's a centuries project. A never to be completed project. But an urgent, personal project. So the question still gets asked every day. Still needs to get answered every day. Really doesn't matter what exactly it means that Simon Peter has the power of the keys to bind and to loose. But it really does matter what answer you give to the question. And you, who do you say that I am? Sisters and brothers, let us pray.